Thanks again to those that helped us open the meeting by reading, and welcome those that have joined us since we first started. I'm glad you're with us. We hope you're going to hear something that's going to encourage you to keep coming back. So yeah, we are a speaker meeting this evening, and it does fall on me to introduce our speaker. So it gives me real pleasure to introduce the gentleman that's come along to share for us tonight. We kind of met a few months. We've kind of met each other over the last couple of 3 months since I've been over here. And I've always liked what he's had to share about his recovery and the way he shares about recovery and his understanding of our program. We've had some interesting conversations in the meetings after the meetings over the last couple of months, which has been really, really interesting stuff. It's always good to hear different perspectives. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to Corey P, who's come along to share his experience, strength and hope with us, his journey into and through Narcotics Anonymous. For the next 40 or 45 minutes, whatever he's comfortable with. Corey did have a pretty major clean time moment this week. I'll leave it to him to share that with you if he so chooses. So, Corey, the floor is yours. Please share with us. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Addict named Corey.
Good morning. Hi, Corey.
Welcome. Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to those in the UK. Today I am 20 years, 5 days clean. I celebrated this past Monday, and I have to admit that when I first came into this fellowship, I didn't think I would make it a year. I didn't think I would make it a week, but I remained vigilant, and I did not do this alone. I was in a rehabilitation center. I went in there on New Year's Day. And I was supposed to stay for 28 days. But because of insurance reasons, they kicked me out on the 23rd of January. That's my clean day. See, while I was in rehab, I was a captive. There was nothing I could do in there, good, bad, or indifferent. And the real test came when I stepped out of rehab. And that was a test. Before I left the rehabilitation facility, I was told to make a meeting as quickly as possible, get a home group, and to get a sponsor. With the help of hospitals and institutions, or what's called H&I, I had an understanding of what these mission statements for me were by getting a home group, by getting a sponsor. I got out of the rehab at 4 o'clock on a Monday afternoon. And I was very shocked to walk out of that rehab and find my wife with the kids in the car. See, I'd put this woman through 13 years of hell. Absolute sheer horror. My wife always had two plans. There was the A plan, carry on life as it is, without him, or B, tolerate him being there. And that was only because I looked for every getaway to you. Sometimes it was simple as putting the kids to bed and my wife going to take a shower, and that was my cue to grab the keys and get the hell out of there. I had a very illustrious career, and I had a lot of money. And that's a real bad combination. Drugs and unlimited amount of money. That is dangerous. Very dangerous. Quite honestly, I'm surprised I survived. My addiction started out on a Friday night, and then it became Friday, Saturday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and so on, until I was using nonstop 7 days a week. The damage I did to my family is unfathomable for me. I knew I was doing harm, but I didn't care. Did I cry at times, high as a kite, screaming to myself in my car as I drove around in a wasted stupor? Yeah. Did God put things for me to recognize? Road signs in my journey through life? Yes. Did I acknowledge them? No. Did I want to do anything about it? No. That didn't start until I came in to recovery, Narcotics Anonymous. I had a sponsor that night at my very first meeting. Oh, wait, let me back up. So I get out of rehab at 4 o'clock. There's my wife. I get in the car and she just looks at me and says, don't say anything. And she drove home. So I sat there in silence. We got home. I showered. I got dressed. I had dinner with the family for the first time in years. Dinner was over. I got up. I helped wash the dishes. Grabbed my keys. Wife said, where are you going? Going to a meeting. And she screamed at the top of her lungs, grabbing for the keys, you're not taking the car. Because you see, that's what I did. I left her stranded without a car, with 2 kids, with life to carry on. Things happened while I was out there using. Kid fell, broke a finger. He had to call a friend to come pick her up, take to the hospital. These were a lot of things that I carried through my life in recovery. I made that meeting, and like they told me in rehab, go in there, sit in the front row, and when they open it up to share, say who you are and why you're there. And you know, the tension built while I was sitting in this meeting, this room filled with people, I didn't know who the hell they were. I was very uncomfortable, especially when that guy at the door grabbed me and hugged me. I didn't like being touched. See, the minute he came at me, I kind of tensed up. And then he wrapped his arms around me and hugged me. And he said, welcome. And my only response was, yeah. Because I was going to punch him in the face for touching me. But I didn't. I sat there. And a woman behind me handed me a blue card. It was an addict. But when they opened it up and they did all the, they came to the readings, they said, would someone please read who's an addict? And I kind of got weak in my chest. And I began to read it. Started to cry. All my life, you never saw me cry. Never let him see you sweat. That's the way I was raised. Come from a military family. I had this false sense of pride because my family was part of the U.S. Navy back to when we were throwing rocks at you folks. And all my life, all I ever heard was, that's not the way we do things. We do it this way. So I read that card and I started to tear up and whimper and choke my way through that reading, the shortest of all of them. And I shut up and they said, thanks for reading. And I noticed this tone that the chair had. It was very calm. It was very soft. It was very serene. It was pretty much like our host Steve's voice. It kind of settled me in. So they had a person speaking that night, and I couldn't tell you what he said. But all I heard was, we're going to open it up to share. Please raise your hand. And I jumped up out of my seat with my hand up in a church basement, and I hit that drop down ceiling and the tile moved. And the chair looked right at me and says, I guess you want to share. And it took everything I had in my body, in my being, saying, my name is Corey and I'm an addict. So I shared. I shared who I was. I shared what I thought I was. See, my understanding of what I was a piece of garbage, piece of shit, no good bastard. Then I heard other people sharing. And in my head, I said, have these people been following me? Well, what's going on? They know me. They know what I've done. Have they been watching me? See, now, this is where I get all sorts of, you know, panicked and stressing out, you know, because my entire 13 years out there, I avoided the police, I avoided doctors, and I avoided my family and loved ones. Friends I had growing up wanted nothing to do with me. But now I'm in this unfamiliar place, and people are talking about the things I've done with repetition. Some of them screaming, others calmly, and talking about these things like steps and traditions and a new way to live. And I had no clue. So the meeting was 2 hours long, and there was a break in the middle. And it was a 15-minute break. And back when I came in, you used to be able to smoke, you know, in the meeting, but everybody would go outside and smoke and drink coffee, and people were huddled in little groups talking and laughing, having a good time. The only good time I was interested in for 13 years was, where's my guy? How much more can he bring me? Till the end, when it was, what do you have and how can I get it? So in that break, of course, here's me, standing all by myself off in a corner smoking a cigarette. And four guys walked up to me, said, hey, how you doing? What's going on? So I said, yeah, hi, my name's Corey. And they said their names and shook hands. And one guy says, we don't shake hands, we hug. Oh, Christ, here we go again with the hugging, you know? And we got to talking, and I heard the term, you're in the right place. You're going to have to get over this feeling like you don't belong here, because you know what? You're amongst a bag of misfit toys. We're all broken, but we change what we change today. Tomorrow, we're a little less broken. So one of the guys, much shorter than me, had a bad limp, walked with a cane. He introduced himself. I said, how you doing? And he says, I'm good today. And I said, I'm supposed to find a sponsor. And then I proceeded to ramble on. You know, I don't know what I'm doing, blah, blah, blah. I don't know if I want to be here. And he just stopped me. And he said something that I say to this very day to newcomers. Is there a question in there someplace? Question. Well, I need a sponsor. Oh, okay. So what's your question? Well, I need a sponsor. Well, you would have to have somebody, wouldn't you? And I said, I guess. He's like, okay. And he just sat there, stood there in silence. And finally I said, would you sponsor me? And his exact words were, absolutely. Here's my phone number. Call me every day. And I did. In that meeting, they pass around pamphlets and meeting lists. And on the back of the meeting list, the last page looked like a notebook. It had lines. And when I said, my name's Corey and this is my first meeting, a meeting list, unbeknownst to me, started circulating around this meeting of, oh, 75 people. And at the end of the meeting, before they closed it, a person handed me this phone, this meeting list. It must have been 60 guys' numbers. And all it said was the name, the phone number. Some of them wrote in small letters, call me. You know. And then I heard the phrase, dial them, don't file them. Well, by the end of the week, I had five meeting lists. hundreds of numbers, I still felt weird. You know, the only people I called was my dealer and all the women that ran with me because of what I had. And I got what I wanted. But now I'm cold calling people. I really don't know. So I kept making meetings. And I did call my sponsor every day. And he'd say, I'm going to this meeting. Maybe you should try it. So I did. And you see, with repetition, not even knowing which way was up yet, I started making the same meetings over and over again. I got to meet and recognize people. You know that you walk into an empty room and there's a bunch of people and you see somebody familiar and you lift your chin up and give them a little nod like, hey, how you doing? Yeah, that's a New York thing. And I got accustomed to seeing them and then talking to them. And the speech became more and more free. And the understanding began to, the fog began to lift. And the understanding grew and grew and grew. Look, I came into this fellowship to save my marriage. You can't do this for anybody but yourself. Found that out in a very harsh way. See, my wife always had the preconcept that this is never going to last because he's gone a week. You know, he's gone 6 days. He's gone 3 days. And I don't want him here because he's nasty when he's not using. So I'd rather him be out of the house and using. Sounds pretty messed up, but if you imagine the 13 years of hell I put her through, you'd get to understand that. And some of you probably do understand that. Because we not only do we harm ourselves, we harmed every single person around us. My wife left me in my ninth, on the day I was getting my yellow key tag, 9 months. I came home from work and she was gone. All the drawers in our bedroom were upside down and empty on the floor. Kids' bedrooms were empty. Same thing with the drawers. The toys were gone. The Nintendo was gone. Their shoes were gone. Coats. So I got on the phone and started calling her frantically. And she wouldn't answer. And I started calling her mother and her brothers. And they just hung up on me. 2 hours later, there was a knock on my door. The sheriff. Here in the States, it's a blue paper. And he tapped me with that blue paper. It's called physical service. He served me with separation papers and an order of, order of protection. And on that order of protection, it said, against, from, her. And as far as she goes, it said, whereabouts unknown. Wow. So I kind of got freaky. I'm still nervous, you know, not having the brain power to comprehend. Hey, I'm in recovery and I'm doing the right thing. How could you do this to me? What the hell did I do? So what came natural? I broke down and cried. And I literally slid down the door on my ass on the floor crying. And the sheriff took pity on me. He helped me to my feet, walked me to my dining room table, sat me down. And on the table was my basic text. He took his gun belt and his hat off and hung it on a chair at the opposite end of it. And he sat down next to me and he said, hi, my name is X and I'm an addict. Yeah, you can imagine the look on my face. I avoided these guys like the plague. Now here's a cop telling me he's an addict. He asked me, you have a sponsor? I said, yeah. He's like, maybe you should call him. And I couldn't even see. My eyes were so filled with tears. And he asked me, who's your sponsor? And I told him. And he got his phone out and he dialed a number. my first sponsor passed away. And he called and he said, Bobby, I'm here with your sponsee. I just served him with papers. Within 10 to 15 minutes, not only my sponsor, but a dozen men were in my house. Not only just in my house, they sat and watched me scrub in my kitchen floor for hours. I was mentally vacant. I was gone. The only reason I know that I was cleaning my floor for hours is because there was a bald spot on the tile from where I was scrubbing it. They started talking to me. And finally, after 18 hours and sleeping in my home, on the floors, on the couches, they asked me, what do you want to do? And you see, right there was my opportunity. I'm going to get away from these guys. I'm going to say I'm fine. And when they leave, I'm going to jump in my truck and I'm going to drive the 65 miles back to my old neighborhood and I'm going to get wasted. Basically, I'm going to show you. But God showed up. And I told them, take me to the psych ward. And they did. And they pulled up in front of the emergency room. And they sat there in the cars while I walked in. Walked in, and the nurse asked me, can I help you? And I said, I think I'm having a mental breakdown. And she says, okay, come with me, dear. She took me in. I stayed there for 14 days, and that was a timeout, is what I call it. See, something made me say, take me to this. Something made me say. And that little pause, that little bit of time that I got there, got my head screwed on straight. And guess what? Who showed up? H&I. The H&I guys, I knew from the 9 months of meetings I've been going to. And they were like, hey, Corey, it's good to see you. You okay, man? What's going on? I heard what happened. Yeah, I'm okay now. All right, man. Well, if listen, when you get out, if you need a ride, call. I'll come get you. And I did. I didn't have a car with me. They drove me there. This is when I realized that these people weren't in it for what I had. They weren't in it to take what I had. They were there to give. And they did. They gave me support. And they gave me love. It was huge. It was huge. You know, my ideal love for many, many, many years was man, woman, bed, bar, bye. Done. Next. That's the way it was. Not today. So I went home from the psych ward and my sponsor came about 2 or 3 hours later. He opened up the basic text and we started reading step one. And we finished and we had a discussion on step one. You didn't take out the step working guide. We just discussed it. Talking about surrender and powerlessness. And clear as a bell, I can tell you, and I've got bad memory these days. Surrender, it wasn't even in my mind at the moment. All I had was anger and disdain. It took a while for me to recognize what I'd done to my wife and my kids and the larger family at hand. So I had a court appearance on December 24th. That would be Christmas Eve here in the States. And I went to that court appearance. And from the end of the middle of October to December, I had nothing better to do than make meetings and read New York State family law. That's all I did, nonstop. Well, December 24th, I took my will back. And my lawyer got up to postpone the court appearance at $450 an hour, which I really didn't have. I fired him in front of the judge. Yep. And I turned around and looked at my sponsor, who was sitting in the audience with a gallery behind me. And he put his face into his hands, shaking his head. And I turned around and looked at the judge. I said, "Your Honor, I'm going to represent myself." The judge says, "This is not a wise thing to do." And I told the judge, "I understand." So we proceeded. She gave me the rules. I already knew the rules. And would you know that I beat my wife on 10 questions out of 10? Come to find out, she lied. She lied a lot. She got caught in a lot of lies. But you see, right then and there at that moment, when the lies became evident, not just to me and to the court, but to the judge, the only thing I could think of in my mind was, nail her. Nail her. Hit her with perjury charges. Throw her ass in jail. But I didn't. I didn't say it. And guess what happened 10 minutes later? The judge told her, very angrily, by the way, "You make sure you have those children at his house tonight at 6 p.m. I'm giving Corey my cell phone and my home phone number. And if you're not there by 6 p.m., I'm going to issue a warrant for your arrest." Wow. Now I look back at my sponsor, and my sponsor just looks up at the ceiling, you know, and he's pointing his finger at the ceiling, and I'm like, "What does he mean?" And court's adjourned, and my sponsor says, "You know, you really took a chance." He's like, "Yeah, I guess I did." God showed up. God saw me. God heard me. All I asked God was, "Please let me see my kids. Because my kids mean the world to me." And it happened. Moving forward, I tried to continue to maintain the relationship with my kids' parent mother. But you know what? She wasn't having it. She wasn't having it. Slowly over a period of time, I learned to accept the fact that I cannot change certain things, but I can have the courage to change the thing, to know the difference. You know, we read that Serenity Prayer, and some of us read it because it's something that it's instilled in us, it's ingrained in us, but have you ever said it and listened to the word? Says a lot. Really says. And that's the thing. My ears became open. My eyes started to open. I started to move through my step work, you know. And when I was wrong, I've only had two sponsors. My first sponsor died in my 18th month clean. Died from a massive stroke from 7 years of crack use. Sweetest guy you ever want to meet. You know, my family in New York, on one side of the family, were all cops. Ironic, huh? I've never been to a funeral that large. There were thousands of addicts in the street at the funeral. For a drug addict. But he died clean. Bobby was an instrument. He was my valiant sword through the darkest of nights. And I love that guy to this. I talk to him all the time. You know, when Bobby died, I made the meeting that night. And it's Recovery 101, the same hospital that I was in the psych unit. And guy walked into the meeting that I recognized, and he came up and he gave me a hug, and he's like, "Yeah, Bobby's a great guy. He's going to be missed." And he says, "So have you gotten a new sponsor?" And I just looked down at my feet, because that's what I normally would do. And I looked up and if right out of my mouth, "Hey, would you sponsor me?" He said, "Absolutely." And that's a term that I use every time an addict asks me to sponsor. Absolutely. See, it's not up to me for you to follow your recovery. It's up to you to follow your recovery. All I can do is open the door and guide you through it. And maybe, just maybe, if you're willing to make the effort, heard that before? Make the effort. You too can have what I have. I'm married 3 times. I'm married right now 13 years to my first girlfriend. I was 15, she was 14. We're married 13 years now. Do we bicker? Sure, we have squabbles. You know, the wife is always right. And recovery sure does help because I have to learn to just shut my face and say, "Yes, dear." We watch TV holding hands. Swear I'm getting old. I went to bed yesterday, I was 40, I woke up 59, and I, where the hell did it go? You see, my recovery grew with time. Yes, in the first year I was screaming and cursing the sky and everything else, the dog, the grass, the neighbors, the guy at the supermarket, whoever. It was because I was angry. I was violently angry at everybody except for the same person that caused all this. Me. Me. The guy that points in the mirror with the 3 fingers pointing back at himself, that's who the guilty party is. That's the guy that needs to straighten it out. I'm the one that has to straighten that guy out. And how do I do that? I make meetings. I come here and I talk to you. 90% of the time I sit and listen. Because, and I've said, today was my 20th celebration at my home group. And I hate anniversaries because I used to live a very cocky life, very full of myself. Excuse me. And when people start, you know, saying, "And Corey's such a great guy, and he's always there for me, and, you know, he knows what you're thinking before you're about to say it, and, you know, oh, I hate when my sponsor says stuff because he's always right," and it's not about being right. It's about what it says in our literature, you know? This is simple, you know? We're the ones that make it complicated. So I did my celebration. And it was chaos. It was absolute chaos. And field of my employment was broadcast television and film. And we have things done a certain way. And this meeting was just going sideways left and right. And I had co-hosts messaging me and, "What's going on? Why are they doing this?" And all I could say is, "Give yourself a break. Just sit back and let the dice roll where they will. We'll get through this together." And we did. You know, I told you what I did for a living. That's why I had a bottomless pit of money. I'm not trying to brag, but in the 1990s, I made more money in a week than most people made in a month. And I burned it. I literally threw it into a blast furnace. I was blackballed. I was literally grabbed on a show while we were on the air and dragged out of the building and thrown into the gutter. I don't know if you've ever been in New York City, but the gutters are pretty disgusting. Come to find out that I was blackballed from my union because I got caught using. Nobody would hire me. Well, I came to recovery and I walked through my way through the process of recovery and I got to 18 months and, you know, Bobby had died and now I got my new sponsor and I'm rolling along and, you know, I can't pay my bills and life's starting to get really bad and I don't know what I'm going to do. And oh my God, this, and I got to take the dog to the vet. She's sick. And I blah, 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 blah. And then I got a phone call. I answer the phone. Hey, Corey, it's me. And I said, hey, man, how you been? And he's like, the question is, how are you? This is one of my old bosses. And I says, doing good. And his exact words were, are you off the shit? And I kind of, you know, shyly said, yeah. And he said, what are you doing about it? I says, well, I got this program. And he says, is it working? I said, yeah. He says, you want to work? I was like, yeah. He said, show up here tomorrow morning at 4 a.m. I was floored. Why did my phone ring? Why did my phone ring and one of my old bosses call me and ask me if I wanted to work when all was lost? Wow. So from that point forward, I worked up until 2018 when I retired. I was a worker bee, okay? I did fill various positions in my field. You know, I was a lighting guy. I'm the guy you see up at the concerts, up in that metal bar up there where the lights hang. I'm the guy doing the monkey thing from light to light. Became a cameraman. Very important job. And then something happened. I want to direct a show. I said, what? Wait a minute. They just asked me to direct. Forget how much money it is. I was just enthralled that somebody was willing to take a chance on me. You see, someone said to me, you know, you're not the same anymore. You're not all gray and sweaty with beady eyes darting back and forth looking for a door to get out of. You're really a great employee. I wish I had 50 of you. That's recovery. I practice these principles in all my affairs. Some people say it's luck. I don't call it luck. I call it God. I was one of those kids that grew up with forced Catholic religion. I'm a member of the Broken Knuckle Club. I know what it's like to be kicked around by priests and nuns and brothers. Literally, physically on the floor being kicked around like a football, you call it over there, we call it a soccer ball. I hated it. And then it came to this realization and recovery. You know, I was born Catholic. And every once in a while, I'd talk to a priest. I'd stop at a cathedral or a church and walk in and sit in the back row and commune, meditate, quiet myself. Talk to God. Because you see, the God of my understanding is not going to throw me into a pit of fire. God of my understanding knows me because he made me. He also knows that I'm fallible. The man upstairs knows every friggin' thing about me, good, bad, or indifferent. And he accepts me for who I am. And he's always there. But I have to choose to listen. Today I do, for the most part. Yeah, there's times when I bend the rail a little bit, lean against the wind, you know, but pay the results. And I get on the phone with my sponsor, and I tell him, you know, what I did. You know, he'll say, what did we learn? I'm like, yeah, I know. He's like, stop being a newcomer. Because, see, the words I know comes out of a newcomer's mouth consistently. And when I came in, when you said I know, the exact thing that came out of guys with some time's mouth was, you don't know shit. You want to know what you know? Take the basic text, turn to the last page in the book and look at it. It's blank. That's what you know. Wow. Yeah. So let me kick back for a second. My 1 year anniversary, I'm alone. It's just me, my sponsor, and a room full of addicts. And there was one other celebrant. His family was there, and he had like 9 years clean. And you see, I learned early on to stick with those people that I see making it, you know. I didn't hang around with the guys after the meeting at the diner that were jumping up and down, wearing NA hats and T-shirts and jewelry with key tags hanging down their belt, dragging on the floor behind them, and screaming and acting like gutter snipes and punks and bullies and thugs and thieves in the alley while people are trying to sit there with their children and eat and have a quiet meal. See, that's what I learned not to do. So I stayed away from that. Some people would say, stick with the winners. And that's what I did. Some people say I came out of rehab, hit the ground running, and never looked back. But deep down inside, which I never told anyone except for my sponsor, yeah, I was looking back and sideways and up and down. My eyes were darting around because I was lost like a leaf in a hurricane. But guess what? The storm passed. It got easier. Eventually, you know, it says in the literature, we didn't become addicted in one day. So give yourself a break. Easy does it. Take it easy. Lighten up. And that's what I learned to do. So that anniversary, my mother was there. And they called on me to speak, and I got up, and of course, you know, I thanked the God of my understanding and my sponsor and the fellowship and, you know, people that trust me now in my life, you know. He said, would the family like to say anything? And my mother got up and said, I don't know what you people are talking about because my son doesn't have a drug problem. Wow. Yeah, what does she know? She's a drunk. Honestly, it is. My mother would have half a beer and she was going cross-eyed hearing voices. My dad, you never knew he was drunk until he wasn't drinking. My dad was a good man. He's a really good man. He had to deal with my mother. God rest his soul, he had patience. But you know what? I'm going to get to my mother in a minute. And then the door opened to the meeting basement room. And in walked my wife with the kids. My sponsor knew who she was. A couple of other addicts knew who she was. And I started to lean. I was going to go down. I was like almost like the air got sucked out of the room. And he held me up and he's like, steady, steady. And the chair said, would any other family members like to say anything? And my son broke free of my wife. And ran up front and said, my daddy is gone. I'm sorry. My daddy is clean today. My dad's there to watch monster movies with me Friday nights. Oh. And he was 5 years old. And he knew. Everybody cries. And that one's hitting hard because I think about these things and I'm so grateful that I don't have to be like that anymore. My wife said it would never last. So let's flash forward. 5th anniversary, they handed me a bag of marbles. Some of you may not know what that means, but they literally hand you a bag of marbles. Usually it's like 50 or 100 marbles in a plastic or mesh bag. And there's always a statement. Put them someplace safe. Don't play with them. So I went home after the meeting with my son and my daughter. And I went downstairs to answer the phone and I heard this sound upstairs in my bedroom on the hardwood floors. It sounded like rain. but harder. I got off the phone and I ran upstairs, and sure enough, all the marbles were scattered all over the phone, all the floor. My son had broken into the bag and started playing with them, and I freaked out. I called my sponsor. He's playing with the marbles. Oh my God, he's playing with the marbles. Like, we lied. The law. One of these things we signifies for. You get your marbles back. You ain't all right, but you're not all there, but you know what? You're here today, and that's all that matters. Flash forward to my second marriage. I had a bad habit of saying this. I met my second wife in the rooms. I had 6 years and she had four. I believe it was four. And I asked my sponsor if I could ask her out. So he said, have you spoken to her? And I said, yeah. And what'd you tell her? I said, maybe you should ask your sponsor. And she did. And both sponsors agrees that it was okay for us to date. Big mistake. Huge. You know why? Chugging along in my recovery. She was a registered nurse dealing with cancer patients in the hospital in intensive care unit. And she slowly started to stop making meetings. 1 week, 2, 4, 6. I don't have the time. Okay, well, I'm going to a meeting. One day, I get a phone call from one of her girlfriends at work. Corey, you got to get up here now. They grabbed Amy and they're dragging her out of the building. The cops are coming and she's at the curb with a box. I was like, what happened? Get up here. So I drove as fast as I could up to the hospital, and there she is sitting on the curb with two hospital cops armed and a box on her lap, and she's crying. Okay, get in the car. And the cops stood there and said, okay, now leave the property. Don't ever come back. So we're driving home. I'm like, what the hell happened, Amy? What the hell happened? She wouldn't answer me. We got home, and she said, I've been using. I said, what do you mean you've been using? She says, they caught me stealing injectables from cancer patients. Wow. She was stealing injectable opiates from cancer patients and shooting them up with saline. Yeah. Right away, I'm going, I'm waiting for the cops to show up and arrest her for murder or manslaughter. So I said to her, what do you want to do about it? And she goes, I don't know. Want to go to rehab? Okay. I drove her to rehab. She stayed for the 28 days. I went to the first couples counseling meeting at the rehab. And I said, how the hell were you doing this? How do I, you know, a man knows his wife's body upside down and sideways, you know? And counselor said, show him. She took her shoe off and her sock and spread her big toe from her the other toe. And there it was, track marks. Wow. I was stunned. I was an addict, but not that kind of addict. So when I was done there, I raced home and started tearing apart the house. I got into the bedroom. I started opening drawers, taking them out, looking under there for false compartments and stuff. You know, real Sherlock Holmes shit, you know. And flipped the mattress over and flipped the box spring over, you know, and a box spring underneath it. Like sheer cover underneath, and it had a cut in it. And I reached inside and there was a shaving bag and I pulled it out. And inside were needles and little bottles of, you know, certain kinds of opiates in liquid form. And I was like, wow. I called my sponsor and he came running over. I says, hey, man, oh, geez, you're not going to believe what I found. Oh, my God. And he's like, I wouldn't have seen it coming. Yeah, he was such a nice girl. Right up until she used. She got out of rehab. and 3 days later, she vanished on me. I called her, called her, called her. She wouldn't answer. Me, her mother, her father, and her brother drove all over our town looking for her. Couldn't find her. And would you know, I drove by where she was 50, 60 times, you know, in this mad chase. And finally, 3 o'clock in the morning, she called and she said, I cheated on you. I'm at this diner. I reached up there and picked her up, and I'm looking for the guy that she cheated on, you know, cheated on me with. And she said, I didn't call you until he was long gone. It was a guy from rehab. So that started getting really weird really fast. I got sick. She had stolen the money out of the bank. She wrecked my truck. I had no way to get around. I'm a diabetic. I couldn't get my insulin. I couldn't go food shopping. I was isolated. I called people for rides. Nobody came to pick me up. And what happened? I started urinating really dark, dark, dark brown. That's not good. I didn't want to call an ambulance. I didn't want flashing lights and sirens on my street at 3 in the morning. So I grabbed that jar. You know the jar, the one we keep all our change in? Called a cab. And the guy picked me up. I got in the cab and he says, where to? And I said, take me to the hospital. On the other side of the island there. And we're getting up there and I just lean forward and I put this really big whiskey decanter of change on the seat. And he looked at it and he said, is that all you got? I said, yeah. And he goes, that's not going to cover it, pal. I said, I'm sorry. It's all I have. And he said, well, you can owe me. I had one thing in my hand again. My basic text, because I knew I was getting admitted. And he saw it, and he handed me the change backs and said, it's all right, brother. Keep coming back. God damn. There it is again. There it is again. They had to put me in an induced coma. And when I came to, it was this woman holding my hand. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, this isn't a cop. Definitely ain't a nurse. I said, who the hell are you? She said, it's Vicky. I said, Vicky who? She said, this is a New York accent. She said, Vicky from around the corner. And it was like, you know, electricity going through a wire, you know, that time warp thing. And she found out what was going on. From my brother in Facebook. She left her home and her job in Massachusetts and drove all the way to Long Island. It's about an 8-hour drive to come take care of me. She came to take care of me, my angel. And when I got out of the hospital, she stayed and she took care of me. She rested me up. She cooked. She cleaned. You know, when we got to my house, on the walls in bright red spray paint, said, you're the son of a dead spick whore. Yeah. I'm Irish and half Puerto Rican. It's a terrible mixture. But anyway, my mom had died December 16th of 2008. And it was a couple of months later that she said this. She wrote this on the wall. So like I said about my mom was a drunk. She was vicious. Set me on fire. She threw boiling water on me. She tried to stab me numerous times in her drunken delusions. And I, as a child, had to find ways and means to hide, to protect my life. To this very day, I can remember my mother's oldest sister, my aunt, phone number. In New Jersey, 201-726-7677. Because Aunt Gloria would come and beat the shit out of Mommy and tie her up and throw her in the hospital and take care of me, rescue me, save me from this crazy woman. My mom came down with dementia in 2006, and it got really bad. Nursing home. But before I put her in a nursing home, I closed up her apartment 60 miles away and moved her to my home. This is the woman that tried to kill me in her drunken stupors, but now she's alone and helpless and can't do anything for herself and is lost. I took care of her, and she passed. Aside from my wife and my kids, the only other people were there, my present wife, and members of Narcotics Anonymous in a blizzard, hip deep. Addicts showed up at my mother's funeral. Nobody else from the family. Again, support. Support. You see, I made an analogy earlier in my anniversary meeting. And I hope you get this analogy. We are like a bicycle wheel, and there are many spokes around that wheel. And when one spoke breaks, it's up to the rest of the spokes to carry the load so that the wheel can continue to spin. Well, I've been that broken spoke many times. And that wheel continued to spin until I could fix myself with the help of others in Narcotics Anonymous. Anyway, enough of the misery. Let's get on to the good stuff. I'm working. I'm back being the normal guy. Everybody loves Corey. I'm in a position of management. I'm working with hundreds of people and directing and making money and buying cars, you know, going to meetings. And at one point I was making like 3 meetings a week. You know, you never know what it's like until you're sitting 60 feet above a concert stadium floor, working on a light, and you mash your finger on a bolt and say, God, and the guy behind you said, grant me the serenity, and you turn around and go, what happened? I shit you not, it happened. And the funny thing is, 2 other guys chimed in, and we continued to work, but we started talking about recovery, 60 feet above a concert floor, and the boss gets on the radio and says, what are you guys, having a meeting up there? Let's get this done, come on. And we kind of looked at each other. We shrugged. And I got on the radio like a wise ass and said, yeah, we kind of are having a meeting. He's like, knock it off. Get the work done. You see, the funny part is that when I mashed my thumb and said, God, well, I said, oh, God, but, you know, somebody answered me behind me. And I guess he thought he was being cute. But you see, recovery is some serious business. We've got to remind ourselves to give ourselves a break. We can laugh. I mean, I've heard some of the best jokes in recovery, you know. Some today I may question, you know, some things just shouldn't be said today. But you know what? That's okay too. More will be revealed. As we make this journey in recovery, things will change for the better. I'm on my second house. I've owned the last one and sold it. I have this house now in Florida, originally from New York City, and I feel like a fish out of water. But I'm retired. My wife works from home. We've got 4 stupid cats, and I can make meetings right here in my house. Unfortunately, I'm in a wheelchair. Been in that wheelchair since April of last year. And you want to talk about a trip down a dark, dirty rabbit hole, I took it. April, May, June, even into July, I was just miserable. The depression set in. I can't walk. I need assistance to walk, and I don't mean a cane. I have to wear leg braces to walk because my legs aren't there. They're there, but they're just useless. But I'm over it. In time, things will change. But am I going to sit in bed every single day and cry and bitch and moan and whine? I can't walk. I just lost a brother in recovery with cancer. Never heard him cry. I'm not talking about pain. Living in the pity box. He lived every day of his life to the fullest, right up until the day he died. That was 1 year ago today. I talk to him all the time, too. I miss him calling me and saying, Brad Rising, Corey, just like that. Weirdest guy. I wish you could have met him. Kept me alive. You keep me alive. They process. The gravy comes after you eat the meat. Don't eat the meat, you can't have your pudding. Look, I'm going to end here. We make of this program what we will. But we don't have a will. We have to let go of our will. We have to allow God into our lives, of our understanding. We have to start somewhere. The steps and the traditions are written in order for a reason. You must put your socks on before you put your shoes on. Because trying to do it the other way, you're going to look kind of stupid. You know what I mean? This is a blueprint to help us see. Because if we don't, we die. You know, just for today, jails, institutions, or death. You can get out of jail. You can get out of an institution. But you ain't getting out of death. And I'm not talking about being hit with the paddles and brought back to life. I mean flatline, covered with a sheet, in a black bag, in an ice box. You're done. And guess what you've done? Not only to yourself, but to your family. You've caused harm again. So let's stop hurting ourselves. Let's stop hurting others. Let's be kind. Let's love each other. Let's come to an understanding of what our recovery will do for us, because we are individuals. We come together in a common purpose to help each other stay clean. And we do it out of love. I've heard some hellacious things in the last 2 months. People telling sponsees to go out and use and fuck you and get high and die. And yeah, I've heard that. And you know, hosts of meetings talking negatively about a newcomer. And that's not what we do. So when I hear this, what do? I change venues. And what we call here in the States, we beat feet and walk. My dealer don't answer the phone, I go to the next one. Well, if I don't hear what I want to hear in a meeting and what I need to hear, I go to the next one. I find others. There are 2,873 meetings worldwide every single week. Why should I stick on just one that's full of negativity? I'm going to wrap it up. Steve, thanks so much for asking me. I appreciate it. I hope nobody fell asleep because I tend to talk. That's all I got. And thanks for letting me share.